Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Makone Maja. Let us get into our stories of today. And today we're going to be talking about some recent polling from the Social Research Foundation about South Africans' beliefs in various economic policies. Now, this is quite interesting. I'm not sure particularly what made the SRF decide to do this poll at this particular time. But I think it says a lot about the way the political debate works in South Africa. So the polling asked people the question, the government should stay out of the economy and let the private sector lead development, or the government must play a central role in managing the economy and directing development. And then they broke down the response first by racial group and secondly by party political support. And they found that, by and large, as the sort of lazy analysis of South Africa might expect, Black South Africans were far more keen on state intervention, and white South Africans and Indian South Africans were far more anti-state intervention, with about 70% of white South Africans saying that the first statement was more something they more strongly agreed with. And about 65% of Black South Africans saying the second statement, that the government should take the lead or play a central role, was more important. So, you know, if the poll simply stopped there, it wouldn't be that interesting. But they dug further. They firstly also asked that, as I said, of the different political parties, and they found that, as one would expect, the DA supporters tended to be more free markety oriented than state development oriented, but it wasn't a super stark difference. MK supporters, interestingly, seem to be the most anti private sector, which is also something I guess you might expect, and a similar thing from ANC voters as well. But then the poll asked more specific questions about practical examples of state intervention in the economy. And all of a sudden, the differences between political parties, race groups, and whatever begin to disappear. So the question was asked, government should determine where you start your business in what city, town, or province. Do you agree or disagree? 70%, more than 70% of all South Africans, including just under 70% of Black South Africans, disagree. Government should set the prices of your products or services. Do you agree or disagree? Once again, over 60% of people disagree. Government should determine the race of the staff you are allowed to employ. Do you agree or disagree with this statement? Only about 30% of Black South Africans agreed, whereas over 50% disagreed in this polling. The one area of state intervention that was the most popular was government should determine how much ownership of your business you must hand over to the state in order to get a license to operate. And here, there was just a slight majority of people who disagree. So much more divisive question. The tentative conclusions of the report say that what people say they believe and what they in fact believe are different situations. When you actually ask people practical examples of state intervention in the economy, they suddenly get much more hostile to them. And the conclusion here suggests that this is why, when these sort of state interventionist policies are actually implemented in practice, they're far less popular than perhaps the ANC expects. I don't know, Makone, what do you make of this? I think there is something very interesting here and about what we say we believe, we don't necessarily believe.
I think the question is, do we understand the things we say we believe, right? Because upon further scrutiny and unpacking and drilling, as the SRF does with this question, is take those larger beliefs and it breaks them up into small questions, you find that there's conflict there. Like you say, people appear to not believe the things they profess. It's been my suspicion for a long time that perhaps it's us in the political class, the political commentary class, you know, academics, analysts, politicians who are confusing South Africans in our message, because perhaps we're not using language that's accessible. And in our use of language that's inaccessible, we're not actually able to extract true beliefs that truly reflect what people or how people think this country should be run. And this poll certainly suggests that. And maybe we need to, we're actually taking this on in our campaigns, I should say, we're tackling the issue of transformation, right? Because transformation has become a weapon of the left, you know, like it's become window dressing and tokenizing, swapping of faces with either females or with people that are not white. But true transformation would actually be the upliftment from poverty across South Africa, majority of whom live below the upper poverty line. So I think that's where the tension lies. It's first in us, political class, who are using inaccessible language, and then in how people are actually trying to make sense of what we're communicating to them, which is, for example, in the case of transformation, economic upliftment. Does economic upliftment, for example, look like the CEO of a company being of one race, or does it actually look like skills development and true upliftment, and investment in community so that they can, by the bootstraps, pull themselves up? And I think that what we tend to do in these debates would be to use the word transformation rather than to explain what we actually mean, right? That's what I'm saying, by our words and our language just creates this barrier where we're not able to penetrate and extract what South Africans truly wish to see reflected in our economy and in our country, and also creates hostility. I think we may find that South Africans are, in terms of how they want to see the economy really run, lean more towards capitalist forms or free market forms and modes rather than the state centralizing power and limiting like freedom to do business, which is ultimately what most of the questions and the answers you read out reflect.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, is that there's this sort of, there's all these kind of shortcut rhetorical devices, and there's these this obfuscating language. I mean, what does inclusive growth mean? Does it mean growth where, jobs are created for poor people? Well, you know, it's very difficult to grow your economy beyond a certain size if you don't do that. So, you know, if you get 7 or 8% growth in your economy, unless it's because you've struck oil, it's very likely that that's because your growth is inclusive. That's really, really good point. And I do also think what this does speak to is that, to a certain degree, the sort of proponents, people like us, political parties that tend to be more free market, have failed in convincing people of the policies, because the natural inclination of a lot of South Africans is actually there's a very strong sort of central through line of common sense, I would say, in most of our country, and it crosses class and racial and gender barriers and all these things. But then when you sort of get to the top line of, are you pro-state or pro-market, suddenly everyone picks a side, which is not necessarily what they actually believe. And I think that is very interesting. And perhaps there's more pressure on people like us to do the work that we try to do every day.
I have to agree. I mean, look at the rise of people like popular figures like MacG, right? He says really insulting things. He's very successful. He started his podcast with like shoddily built set. I think he'd actually go to people's houses. That's how he started before he'd filmed from a studio with all this good equipment he's got now. And so many of us aspire to that level of success and independence away from corporates, just doing your own thing and succeeding in that lane and being able to say whatever you want to say without, you know, the government policing your speech. And so many of his fans, I would guess that if you were to poll his fans on things like free speech, right, with those terms like free speech, freedom of expression, you'd get one answer. But if you made him the example, you'd likely, I'm not sure, but I suspect you'd likely get a different answer. So you are right in that on the free market side, we're not able to express ourselves, and perhaps we're not using the right examples either. That would attract youth or attract people like we opponents.
I'd be interested to know of the people who said that they were more keen on the state intervening in things on any of these questions. You ask them, okay, well, would you eat at a state-controlled restaurant, or would you shop at a state-controlled grocery store? And in those practical terms, I think a lot, even fewer people would be keen on them. They'd be like, well, when you put it like that, maybe not.
Yeah.
All right, let us go on to our next topic. And this is from the Daily Maverick, where they are talking about lots of service delivery protests in Soweto with regards to electricity supply. Large parts of Soweto are constantly undergoing what's called load reduction. Load reduction is basically when it's similar to load shedding, but it's much more specific to a small area. When an area is overloaded on the grid, or I think also sometimes when an area doesn't really pay the bills, Eskom will, at peak periods, switch off the power in those areas. They say this is important for safety, to ensure that the grid doesn't overload and transformers don't explode and fires don't get started, that sort of thing. And there are many areas of Soweto that suffer from load reduction. It often means that power from, it's supposed to be off from about 5 in the morning till 10 in the morning, sometimes till midday during that peak early morning sort of rush as everyone's getting ready for work and putting on kettles and stuff. But many residents all over Soweto say that, you know, while that's kind of the theory, in reality, it doesn't work out like that. Often the power is off for days or sometimes even weeks. Various people interviewed by the Daily Maverick about this say it's very difficult. My children have just begun writing their exams, but it's hard for them to do their studies in the dark. They're here and they're very angry, as you can see. In the decades that we've been here, this is the first time we've engaged in a community protest. Another person said, we took the matter to our counselor who passed it to Eskom. The Eskom contractors promised us they will come and fix the fault, but nothing has happened. Crime has increased dramatically during the outage and our elderly people are struggling to survive. Another person, an old person from Dobsonville said, load reduction, load shedding, we understand the mechanics, but when the outages stretch beyond 3 days a week, the explanation starts to wear thin. Some wards of power, we don't. Basically, the stuff is really disruptive. Now, one of the responses to this, and it's a very fair response, is people say, well, you know, the problem here is one of criminality in these communities. People aren't paying their bills. Particularly Soweto doesn't have a great level of payment of electricity bills. Some people say, well, this is because of electricity being stolen. And McCorner, you were telling me just before the show, you were recently interviewing people in Soweto and you were yourself seeing just, you know, lots of illegal connections all over the place. But you also brought up, and I'd like you to expand on this a bit, that even if people were willing to pay, it wouldn't be so simple. And I just draw people's attention to, for example, in Johannesburg, the billing system in places where the bills tend to be paid in the sort of older suburbs it's not a very strong system. In fact, government is routinely giving people just completely made up bills that don't make any sense, that are way overcharging people, where you can't work out how much you've used from 1 month to the next. And I think really what we're seeing here is just the complete breakdown of trust. Yes, people aren't paying their bills, but wouldn't government also just not be able to tell them the correct amount and try and extort them even if they were willing to pay their bills? I don't know. What's your thoughts on this?
That was the experience of residents from Bramfisher that we were interviewing for a separate campaign, the Right to Own Bill, where we were discussing insecure property rights in the township and how it affects them. And they were pointing to issues like service delivery, that they're not able to exert their rights because they don't own the homes in which they've lived for decades now. And one of the gentlemen was telling me that even with the water bill there, that there's a breakdown in trust between the community and the government, because the government will show up randomly and say, well, your water bill is 30,000, and then on a separate occasion it'll be higher and then maybe lower again, and these government officials will accept bribes to make the thing go away, the bill go away temporarily until the next employee rolls around looking for a bribe and can make the issue go away again. And that's sort of the cycle that's been developed and created by these dynamic between the community and the Gauteng or Johannesburg municipality. And that's what they were saying, is even when we're willing to pay for water, we find it hard to trust the government when they present us with a bill, because these meters are not kept in our homes. They keep them. They get to make up the numbers. They get to make up the figures. And also they point to things like a breakdown in infrastructure. How do we know that, you know, in this interview, you can see just water running on the ground. How do we know that we're not going to end up being made to pay for this? You know, it's hard for them to actually rely on the government to truly bill them accurately. And so it's this conundrum of like breakdown in service delivery and how it affects trust and whether people who are actually willing to pay, right? And usually townships all get painted with the same brush, that they're all breaching and they all don't, and that's not true, that none of them are willing to pay for services that they use. That's also not a true account, right? For these specific community members, they showed an interest. And one of the things they said, what this gentleman also points to, is that he, you know, he's aware of a granny who gets, I don't know, 6,000 liters of water for free a month. And that when the bill, when the billers come around, they'll accuse her of spending maybe 20,000 of liters, and she lives alone. It's just not possible. You know, she's not that mobile to begin with. It's not possible that her consumption could be that high. So are these just corrupt officials looking to make a quick buck and extract bribes from her quickly, and then that one goes away and a different guy presents himself the next time? Or are these actually the bills that these communities have earned? So it really is not just that simple that all of these community members refuse to pay. And there are instances where people breach. I also spoke to you about a trip that I made to Cliptown with members of the French embassy, and they're just meters away from the monument where the Freedom Charter was launched, across the train tracks, a sea of informal settlements with different cables connecting this huge informal settlement illegally. And there it's an open secret that, you know, they consume electricity illegally. But that is not necessarily reflective of every single community. And the Bromfisher community members are certainly an example of that.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a larger political point here, and that this is part of the explanation for why the ANC is really struggling at the moment, I think, to keep its supporters. One of the great successes of the ANC post-94 was rolling out some of these basic services, water, electricity, stuff like that, to huge numbers of people. You know, the number of people who connected to the electricity grid went up massively since the ANC came to power. But the problems with maintenance, the problems with, you know, dealing with these crime problems, the problem, the breakdown of trust between citizen and government has created a situation where the gains of that are, in, I think, in a lot of ways, kind of beginning to be reversed slightly. You know, people may have electricity, as in they are connected to the grid, but if it's all for 4 days a week, then, you know, what's the point? If you are supposed to be paying for water, but you have no idea where the water meter is, it gives you these completely nonsensical numbers. The city doesn't even know how much money you really owe. And half the time it's leaking into the street anyway. Then, you know, do you really have proper access to water? So, yeah, I think that is a part of the story here about how that initial phase of expansion is now suffering from the years of mismanagement and the failure to put in place proper governance systems that can kind of consolidate those gains. All right, let's move on to our last story. And, you know, in that first story, we talked a bit about how licensing was one of the most popular parts of state intervention in the economy, according to that SRF poll. Well, it's also a bit of a burden on economic growth, and government is promising now that it's going to be seeking to reduce licensing requirements, particularly for small businesses. There is the development of a national business licensing policy, which says that it will introduce a common licensing framework for the regulation of trade governed under the general business license, which, once approved for implementation, will guide the development and implementation of any business licensing legislation, regulations, and systems. The idea here is to make it easier for particularly small businesses to become compliant with the law, to be charged less in fees, to have less requirements in order to get a law, comply with the law in licenses terms, and also for there to be more harmonization between different layers of government and bylaws, municipal, provincial, national government on licensing. Now, sounds great to me. It's exactly the kind of thing I think government should be doing. Is it going to happen? Well, this isn't the first time that the government's promised to do such a thing. And it's been talking, you know, every 5 years, even the ANC will talk about cutting red tape, but then never really does it. So I don't know, McCorney, what are your thoughts on this?
Yep, another case of government promise fatigue on my side. The government has been promising to slash the regulatory burden on small enterprises since the first national strategy of 1995, the white paper of 1995. They did this again between 2004 and 2014 with the ISPSE, the Integrated Strategy for Small Enterprises, and then again in 2023, the National Integrated Strategy for Small Enterprise Development, the NISAD. So every 10 years, every decade of our democracy, the government has come up with a new national strategy for SME development, and in it, they identify all the ways in which the SME agencies, government agency, government development agencies are fragmented, and so is the policy, and that, you know, they go in and they identify all the regulatory burdens on SMEs, even in municipalities. It's a well-researched topic. The government is aware. These are not just regulatory burden in terms of licenses, but also in terms of VAT accounting practices, accounting procedures, VAT registration accounting procedures, obtaining premises, although that's less of a problem now because people can just simply work from the comfort of their homes. I am exhausted. The issue of licenses for me is twofold. The first is that it's specifically on small enterprises, it's purely about rent seeking, right? Government creates a fictitious demand by creating these fictitious barriers to entry so that they can collect rents and make an income. And a good example of this is the New York cabs, right? Those yellow cabs in New York, where the city only issues 13,000 medallions in the biggest city, one of the biggest cities in the world, 13,000 medallions, meaning only 13,000 cabs can operate, right? And then the rise of Uber sort of shattered that number, because I think that I looked this up, there's about 77,000 to 90,000 Ubers in New York alone. So again, this is just the city creating a fake demand, fake supply issue, creating backlogs that don't need to be there because they need to raise an income. It's purely a mechanism for rent seeking. And then also on the part of small businesses, that it's so challenging to come up with a business, and the amount of time it takes to register, to obtain a license, the requirement that you renew this license every so often, it also introduces all these laws, all these hurdles and obstacles that as a government that's long identified, it needs to create, it needs to be an enabling force for SMEs to thrive. You know, this article also reflects on the NDP of 2030 and that 90% of the jobs by 2030 are supposed to be created by SMMEs. We are far from that, obviously. In fact, SMEs have been, their share of job creation has been declining since the advent of agencies like the Department of Small Business and Enterprise. They've had the exact opposite effect on SMEs than was intended. So not only are we far from that goal, but we've also created all these other barriers for SMEs to thrive in the country, despite all these strategies, all these agencies, and billions of rands that's been thrown into SME development. It just hasn't produced the results that the government once aimed to achieve.
Yeah, well said. I mean, the fact that we've gone backwards after, you know, specifically having a government department speaks more than anything else ever could to the effectiveness of that department. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We have gone way over time, so we hope you found this show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.